Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week, we take a tabletop RPG mechanic and secretly judge it after it's left the room. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and my co-host this week is Alex Roberts. Alex is a superstar. She's probably best known for Starcross, a two-player game of forbidden love that uses a Jenga tower, and which just funded an expansion, Starcross Love Letters, last fall. Check it out, Bully Pulpit Games. I think of Alex first as the designer of For the Queen, a devilishly simple game that always delivers a quality story and is my go-to for introducing new players to the hobby, and which has a handsome new edition coming May 14th from Darrington Press. Alex was also the host of Backstory, for my money, the best RPG interview podcast of its time, which ended several years ago, but which you can still comb through the archives of for tons of great interviews and lessons on design. Apparently, introducing Alex is an exercise in me recommending all my favorite RPG things. It's a treat to have her on the show. Alex brought in Pity Points from Kagamatsu by Danielle Lewan, an old story game from the aughts set in Sengoku period Japan. In the game, one player, who must be a woman according to the rules, plays as Kagamatsu, a wandering samurai. Everyone else plays as women of a village that's facing some kind of threat. And each of them works to romance Kagamatsu in hopes of convincing him to save the village. Kagamatsu, after every scene, bequeaths to that scene's suitor either a point of love or a point of pity. It's delicious. This episode is what I always dreamed Dice Exploder could be. We start from a simple game mechanic, but we get into power dynamics at the table in the past and the future, how people treat you when you're disabled, cultural appropriation, my personal techniques for flirting, details of a new game Alex is working on, and, of course, what is the true nature of love? Happy day after Valentine's Day. Before we jump in, note that Kagamatsu has been taken out of print by its creators, and there's no easy way to obtain a copy of it. Because of that, we try to be more thorough than usual in our explanations of the mechanics so you can follow along. Okay, here is Alex Roberts with Pity Points from Kagamatsu. Alex Roberts, thanks so much for being on Dice Exploder.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me.
I cannot wait to talk about some sexy samurai with you. So, yeah, tell us about Kagamatsu.
Sure. So Kagamatsu is a game from, I want to say, 2009. That I think was in development long before that, that is about wandering Ronin, who comes upon a village that is in some way kind of helpless or defenseless to a periodic or returning or ominous threat. It takes place in the Sengoku era of Japan, so the idea is that all the able-bodied men and people who could use a sword are off dying in the Shogun's wars. And so for basically the townswomen of this village, who are left behind, try to steer the Ronin from his wandering course and convince him to help them. And so something that the townswomen players are trying to do is basically acquire love. Like, love is a bunch of points. There are love points in this game.
You can get a high score in love.
Yes, you can, finally.
Just like in real life.
But the mechanic that I'm actually so fascinated by is pity, because those are different points that can be handed out by the Kagamatsu player instead of love, kind of as that player chooses. And much like contempt tokens in the Quiet Year, I think it's easy to explain that as, yeah, they don't do anything, right? Or they don't have any mechanical impact, or they seem to not do anything, and yet they actually do a lot.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I could talk about Quiet Year for an hour too, but basically I'm very interested in mechanics that quote unquote don't do anything. That don't get involved in any that are like sort of quantifiable, I guess, but don't enter into any calculation at any point. I'm just totally fascinated by that.
Yeah. All right. So I can't wait to ask you about that, but I want to get into like the nuts and bolts of how do love and pity points work? How are they handed out? Just to establish that up front. So scenes in this game involve the townswoman deciding on an affection that they are trying to get from Kagamatsu. And these range from a stolen glance all the way up to a roll in the hay. Or there's a secret in the middle or whatever. And so you know in the scene what the townswoman is trying to get from Kagamatsu. And you kind of role play out the scene. And then at some point you make a roll that we won't get into the details of to determine whether the woman wins that affection or not. And then at the end of the scene, Kagamatsu decides whether to either give the townswoman a point of love or a point of pity. And he also keeps these totals secret from all the townswomen. Yes. So they're running totals throughout the course of the game. And then at the end of the game, pity, as we said, doesn't quote unquote do anything. But Kagematsu's highest amount of love with a townswoman is used to determine his strength when going up against whatever problem the town is dealing with.
Yes, I think that's a pretty good summary. I mean, basically, there are a bunch of affections. The townswoman player kind of calls their shot at the beginning of their scene. And they're like, okay, in this one, I'm going for a shared moment, a touch, a gift, a kiss, or whatever. And the last one, the one that is the most difficult to get, is a promise made. And so the odds of this game ending in tragedy, like in either Kagematsu just walking away or Kagematsu going up against the thing and failing, are really high, which is one of my favorite things about it. And yeah, ultimately, the townswomen never know what their love score is because they know which things they succeeded at.
Yeah.
But that only tells them their highest potential love, because in every single one of those cases, Kagematsu could have noted a point of pity. And on this very physical level, too, like if you're at the table with people, you see the Kagematsu player make a little mark on their paper. So, you know, like something happened. But yeah, you never know how much love or pity happens until, you know, of course, the end of the game.
What is it? It's such a... I played this just yesterday, and we're all playing over Discord. We have our cameras on. And the way that we were playing was whichever townswoman was in the scene would turn their camera on, but everyone else would turn their cameras off.
Nice.
And this was just not something we like intended. It just sort of accidentally happened. Yeah. But so there would always be a moment between scenes where all the townswomen will have turned their cameras off, and the full screen was just Kagematsu's player writing on a physical piece of paper and going, and like, and it was everyone, all of us were just like, what's happening there?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly as you say.
And I am now thinking about all the times where I have looked down at my little paper and gone, and watched people at a table just like sweating, just panicking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the other rule that sort of hangs over this whole game is that Kagematsu must be played by a woman. Mm-hmm. This game was published in 2009. But I feel like that the game at large is so interested in power dynamics, right? In these relationships. And love and pity, I think, play right into that. Like, love and pity are power dynamics.
Yes, absolutely. And so this is a game that I think engages with power in a really interesting way. It is extremely 2009 in the way it's designed, in the way that it looks, in the people who are involved, everything about it. And like, as someone who was playing RPGs at that time, I don't think I played with another woman or non-binary person until like mid to late 2010s, if I had to guess. So yeah, so when I first got into indie RPGs, I was used to just being the only woman at the table. And that was always whether or not anyone wanted it to be or whether or not it was written anywhere. That's a dynamic. That's something that is happening, right? That has an impact on play. And I mean, the obvious power dynamic that we talk about when we talk about role-playing games is the GM to player power differential. And I think all of us probably have had really bad experiences with the poor use of that power differential, right? This sort of, this joke maybe, or frequent just bad time, of the GM who's power tripping, right? Who's taking advantage of the power differential to do things that they would not otherwise really sort of have social permission to do. And I think there's an equally common joke of the players sort of exerting power in this kind of like, thumbing your nose at authority way, right? The perpetual meme of like, oh, I'm the GM and I created this amazing world and this fascinating story for my players, but then they just wanted to talk to Scrungle, the elf who was supposed to be in there for 5 minutes. Oh, God, you know, or I planned this huge encounter and then my players just wanted to shop and play dress up for 4 hours.
Yeah.
And that joke says a lot, right? That this power is there and that people have different ways of kind of poking at it, playing with it. And so I think a lot of what has happened in RPG design is figuring out GM-less games or figuring out ways to in some way distribute power in a more kind of equal way. The other game that I'm going to be mentioning a lot is The Quiet Year, Avery Alder's The Quiet Year, which distributes power right in that way. It doesn't have a game master. And I think her game, Dream Askew, does that in an even more interesting way, where they're basically the GM's role is broken down into a couple of different things that you do, and then everyone gets a piece of that. So there isn't no GM. It's more like everyone is part of a GM. It's, yeah, it's interesting.
A GM, but only over the digital world or whatever.
Exactly. Or, you know, only over the outcome of this or the outcome of that or saying what this is. So
yeah,
I think that's really interesting. But I am kind of far more fascinated by games that take that power dynamic and try to see how far you can push it and still have fun. The game if anyone's ever talked to me about games in person, they've heard my Paranoia rant, right? Paranoia is this amazing piece of satire. It, you know, comes out in the, I'm trying to think, 80s or 90s, that, you know, this period of time that where people, I guess, were just starting to feel the sting of the misuse of GM power and sort of sets up this whole thing where, like, knowing the rules is against the rules. Everything is against the rules. The players are constantly sinning against the all-powerful friend computer that is hostile to you in every way. And you can be killed with a wave of the GM's hand, and the GM is pitting you all against each other. And it exaggerates that power dynamic in a way that is, like, very funny and I think very fun to play. And I think very kinky, but that's a separate discussion. And so Kagamatsu also plays with that power dynamic in a way that I think is really interesting, and that is not exactly about exaggerating nor equalizing it.
It is trying to, like, offer that power to someone who normally doesn't get it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes. And this is downright difficult to explain if you haven't been playing role-playing games for very long. But, you know, there was some interesting research on, like, business meetings around this time that I got interested in reading. Just about, like, who gets listened to, who speaks up more and less often, who gets listened to, you know, the bit about, like, oh, I said something, but eventually a man near me said it louder, so the suggestion was accepted. And the thing is, all of that played out to some degree or another at the gaming table. And obviously in a better group, it was a lot less often. And I was playing with wonderful, wonderful people who were very, like, conscious of that and would actively kind of seek out contributions from players who were not speaking up as often, or, you know, try to compensate for that dynamic. And so Kagamatsu is this way of compensating for that dynamic to the nth degree. And I have this physical copy of Kagamatsu because my buddy Patrick, who really introduced me to role-playing games other than D&D, really, like, put it in my hands and was like, hey, our group wants to play this. If we're going to do it, you're going to have to GM it. It says so here in the rules.
Yeah.
And my group did the same thing with My Life with Master, which is, again, a different tangent that I GM'd for different but similar reasons. But I was very shy about GMing. And I was very nervous too. I was less experienced and I was younger than other people in the group. And, you know, probably gender was a factor. Probably. Gender is definitely a factor in who decides that they can GM or not. Let me put that there, actually, explicitly. And so there was actually something really beautiful in just being told, like, well, we all want to play this game. Alex, you yourself thinks it's super cool. So if you want, if we want to play it, you're going to have to run it.
Yeah.
And I became absolutely addicted to running it. And I ran it for our group and I ran it for some other friends. And I ran it so many times at game conventions. And because it facilitated a power dynamic that was, again, very different from what I'd experienced at the table before. It was very interesting to me. And also, that's not just me being like, oh, it's fun to have power over people. I really saw a different side of a lot of my players when they were asked not just to play women, but to play people who had to convince someone else to do things and who were powerless to do certain things themselves and had to do so in a way that called upon their own ideas about what is lovable, what is cute, or what is sexy, or what is compelling, or, like, what would elicit the love of another person? And that's not something that I normally, it was just a new side of people that not very many, I think, to this day, role-playing games really elicit in an interesting way. And it was something that just kind of hooked me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have, like, three responses to the thing that you just said. I want to say a couple of them. Mm-hmm. But the first is, like, what a gift to have a game give you a push into GMing yeah. with a rule that says you have to do it.
Yeah.
The game having that bit of like power to encourage people who are maybe nervous about the idea, but also maybe excited about it mm-hmm. to give it a try. I think there's something really lovely in that.
Yeah. And I'm still a little self-conscious as a GM, and I want to encourage other people to try GMing or to, you know, or to play outside their comfort mm-hmm. zone in some way, or to, I don't know, when I play with really shy players and I'm just like, how can I get out your delicious, amazing, beautiful ideas? Because yeah. the people who speak louder don't necessarily have better ideas, my friend. So I don't know how else to like so sternly yet invitingly elicit the first time GM. Anyway, I have very half-baked thoughts about that, and I wish I could do it. But yeah, sorry, that was the first thing. You had two more things.
Yeah, so you mentioned the way that this game sort of opened up a new side in a lot of your players. Mm-hmm. And something that I really noticed in myself as I was playing it was that I learned something about the way that I flirt. Right? Mm-hmm. That like, there's this old story that my partner loves to tell about, we were in college, not together. She's directing this play that I'm in. And in the play, I am playing the brother of the lead, and both of us are interested in the same woman. Mm-hmm. And we are in this scene and rehearsing it and doing a terrible job flirting with this woman. Just absolute dog shit job portraying flirting. And finally, my partner breaks down and she's just like, guys, how do you flirt in real life? And he's like, I talk very loudly. And I like, I stand too close and I don't know what to do. And I'm like, I stand on the other side of the room and I'm very respectful. And like, I saw there was a halfway through this game, you know, I've been with my partner for like 11 years mm-hmm. now, you know, I have not done a lot of flirting since. Mm-hmm. And there was a moment in this game where I was like, I'm standing on the other side of the room and being respectful right now. Like that is the way uh-huh. that I try to make myself appealing to people. And it was in that process, I also sort of noticed, I felt like this was a really great game for introducing people to the idea of role-playing romance in mm-hmm. RPGs. Mm-hmm. Because, first of all, it's sort of actually a series of duet games kind of layered on top of each other. Like, the townswomen don't have a lot of interaction, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that they don't influence each other, because Kagamatsu is sort of looking for differences between the women, right? Like, if I take out a really strong flirty stance, I'm kind of going to be the flirty one. And like, mm-hmm. maybe the other women are going to be less so, right? But it's still not, I'm not doing scenes with the other townswomen. And that makes it, I think, easier to kind of step back and watch your friends like do the romance thing and be like, okay, I can get comfortable doing that. We can all do that. But it's also, by virtue of its setup, it is like ostensibly a game about romance. But you alluded to this earlier. This was like maybe the third thing I wanted to talk about, is how this isn't actually a romance game if you don't want it to be. Yes. Like, none yes. of the people yes. in this game have to be interested in all of them could be genuinely interested in romance. All of these characters could be.
Yeah.
But like, also, if you are Kagamatsu just sort of like taking pity on these women and like helping out the town because it's the right thing to do, and you're like, you know, a gay guy, mm-hmm. like that works. And if you are a townswoman who is just like, I'm going to use the weapons in my arsenal, like pity and sexuality, to like get the job done for the town, that also completely works. And I think that's so fascinating and helpful for coming into romance games for the first time.
Yes, absolutely. I think a great way to explore romance in games is to have another option. Yeah. It's like to have yeah. the option to not. That makes it easier to approach. And you know, sexuality as well. And so, I mean, speaking of seeing a different side of people, like I played this game once with someone who I'd never gamed with before, kind of a friend of a friend. And he sits down to the table and we're all making our characters. And he's like, oh yeah, my character's 14 years old. And I don't think we had the X card back then. I would have X carded it, but I was kind of like, okay, let me hear this guy out. And he ended up being, I think he was my most loved, because Wow. He played this character that was like, that needed Kagematsu, wanted Kagematsu's love so bad. And it was truly in like a purely like parental way. Mm. Like I had this deeply, deeply paternal love for this kid. And obviously she was like an orphan and her dad had died in the war. And there were, you know, obviously like Kagematsu as this Ronin reminded her of her dad in certain ways. And like, she was really like grieving her parents in a way that I think that first of all, like really walked that love and pity line in an interesting way,
yeah.
But was so sincerely lovable in a way that did not in any way kind of have to touch on romance or sexuality. And yeah. That's really interesting to me. And it's not any more or less kind of easy or helped by the game than the players who I've had where they're like, time to seduce Kagematsu.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I'm going to do. And I love both approaches. Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit more specifically about like the love and pity mechanic at sort of a deeper level. Like I'm curious if you have thoughts on what it says that in this game, the only two responses to courtship for Kagematsu are love and pity.
So what I would say is, because again, right, it's not about developing a romantic relationship, although that could be one of the many strategies, I guess, you take, that the townswomen are trying to get something from someone, and because they don't have riches and they don't have, you know, physical power over this other person, the way for them to get what they want is to be loved. And so when you are in a position where you are trying to get people to help you without making them feel like you are just trying to get them to help you, that can result in pity, or it can result in, I mean, people have a lot of different definitions of love, but to me, that is a commitment to the well-being and flourishing of the other person.
Yeah.
And like a lived and active commitment to that. And so that's what happens. And it's something that for various reasons, a lot of disempowered people in it, and I think for specific reasons in under patriarchy, a lot of women kind of have to do that. Well, I can't really do this, you know, because they're the person with the access to power. I need some man to do it. But if he knows that I'm just trying to get him to do it, either he will be angry or feel bad for me. And I think something absolutely essential that this game conveys through its mechanics is that pity does not motivate actions that actually support the well-being of the other person. Love does, and pity does not, which is important. And I agree with.
Wait, can you go deeper on that? Because first, just a bit of context from where I'm coming from is the game of this I played yesterday. We had this really interesting ending where a townswoman who we later learned had only pity managed to secure the promise from Kagematsu. Like she had just achieved a lot of successes, even, but like the successes yielded pity, you know? Mm-hmm. And then at the end, she just rolled a little bit lucky and got there. And so it was like pity was her weapon, you know, like was the thing that had drawn this guy in. And then like a different person had maximum love. That was me. Like I had maximum love. Uh-huh. And then I had previously failed to secure the promise.
Mm.
And so we had this interesting dynamic of like the person with all the love was instrumental in Kagematsu fighting the trouble.
Yes.
And then failing and he died. It was very sad.
Amazing.
But the person with all the pity was instrumental in like getting him to agree to do so in the first place. And I loved it as this like dichotomy of like two weapons, like, you know, again, weapon is such a like wrong word, but like two different strategies achieved different ends, both of which like were needed to actually have a chance of solving the problem at hand.
Oh, that's so interesting. We've had profoundly different experiences because I genuinely don't know like numerically how it would be possible because of the way, I guess it depends on how many dice she would have been able to roll, because the way that sort of success works in the game, right, is like you take the result and then you minus. Okay, so here's another thing about this game being from 2009 is that I have never been able to play it without checking the rule book multiple times and doing at least one thing wrong.
I can explain the dice roll, having done it yesterday, if that would be helpful.
Okay, go for it.
So when a woman is going for a particular affection, that affection has associated with it either charm or innocence, which are the women's two stats. And it also has associated with it a difficulty number. And the women roll a number of dice equal to their charm or innocence, whatever is relevant. And Kagamatsu rolls a number of dice equal to the difficulty number. And there's a little bit of funniness on like sixes, whatever. I'm going to skip that part. But basically, you just like add up the totals on both sides' dice. And whoever got higher, like if the woman got higher, she gets the affection she was going for. And if Kagamatsu gets higher, she does not. And then there are two things that can get added onto this. The first is that Kagamatsu's love for that woman is subtracted from his role. So the more he loves the woman, the easier it is for her to extract an affection from him. And also, if she fails on a role, she can use a desperation, which are things that you sort of gradually accumulate from previous successes. Like you can blackmail Kagamatsu as a desperation, or you can accuse him of impropriety, or whatever the specific ones are that you have unlocked. And when you use a desperation, you like bring it into the scene in some sort of roleplay way, and then you get one extra die to your role as a woman when you do that. And so what had happened in our case here with the guy playing this woman who had all this pity was that Kagamatsu just got a bad role. And then, you know, he didn't have like a lot of charm or innocence, but he had achieved a lot of desperations. And so he just like used all the desperations. He was so desperate. So he rolled a ton of dice and like got there. And it was this like profoundly sad kind of scene of just like, wow, this guy, like she really needs this. And like Kagamatsu does not love this woman. He only feels bad for her. And the more desperate she gets, the more that feels true.
Right, right. Okay, thank you. That was a very thorough and well-phrased explanation. And I've been thumbing through my copy here. And God, I think there's a chance that because I really insist that like either they failed the role and they failed and they get nothing, or if they succeeded in the role, they get either love or pity.
Yeah.
But actually, Kagamatsu can award those based entirely on how the Kagamatsu player feels. And it's only if they succeeded that they get to try for more affections on the scene. Anyway, it's finicky. It's fussy. But the point is, the point is that, like, again, you can acquire the promise, but like pity isn't going to work for Kagamatsu to save the town.
Yeah. If everyone only had pity, then Kagamatsu has nothing fueling him when he goes up against the trouble, right? Like you might extract the promise from him to fight it, but like he doesn't have it in his heart, you know, like he doesn't care about anyone here. And so he's not going to do a good job.
Yes. Yes. Like truly. And I think it's important, again, because someone being kind of helpless can elicit care or can elicit I don't know, sympathy or pity or whatever you want to talk, however you want to phrase that. Like, pity creates distance between people, right? In the same way that love brings them together. And I don't know how common people's sort of experience of this is, but like, I think we've got a whole kind of note in here about love and pity and disability. And like, as someone who needs help with things that not everyone needs help with, it has been, it's an interesting experience to kind of just need help. And I, on a certain level, like, you know, I've been in a position where like, I need someone to get that off the shelf for me, or I need this to happen, or I need this, whatever. And on a certain level, it's like, I don't care why you do it. But my experience is that like the people who love you, I mean, either as, you know, that individual relationship where that's how they feel about people, it's a spiritual commitment, whatever it is. People who are acting from a place of love will be genuinely and very thoroughly committed to like, oh, your needs should be met.
Yeah.
As where the experience of someone just kind of feeling bad for you elicits very little, if anything, of what you actually need.
Yeah.
I mean, I used a wheelchair for quite a while, and the difference between like the person who's like, oh, hey, you need that, or oh, let me grab a door for you, and the person who just comes up and is like, oh, what happened?
Yeah.
Need I say more, right? That
I mean,
explains itself.
Gosh, I like you describing all that. I'm thinking about how much of my own relationship to disability is about avoiding that feeling, about as much as Kagamatsu shows us that you can use pity as a weapon against the person pitying you, I have constructed my life with invisible disability in particular to like avoid people doing that to me because it feels like shit.
Yeah.
I don't want people
to feel bad for me is a very common refrain. And I think, again, like this idea of, well, if someone feels bad for me enough, they might do maybe this one specific thing, but the social toll and the psychic toll will be so incredibly high. And also, it does not, doesn't last the way that love does, right? Like maybe someone will do a specific thing because they feel bad, but it A, is very qualitatively different from someone doing it out of love. And B, the person who loves you will actually be sort of committed in a longer term way to helping you get your needs met, right? In the way that you are committed to helping them.
Well, I think pity in some ways is a selfish emotion on the act of the pitier.
Yes.
It is.
Absolutely. Yep.
You agree. Yeah. Because it is, I think often the woman who is saying that to you when you are using your wheelchair is saying it because she is glad that she is not where you are rather than having any sort of care for you genuinely.
And pity is a way to create distance. Like that creates distance. And again, sometimes the act of doing something quote unquote nice for someone or that they have asked for help with or for whatever, it can be the thing that they want. But it is a way to create distance, and it is a way to maybe, you know, absolve your guilt, right? Oh, this person needs this. Oh, I'll give it to them. And then, oh my God, I feel so bad, huh?
And then it's like a white person who went to the movie about slavery, and now we don't have to feel bad about slavery because they solved it at the end of the movie, right?
Oh my God, yes. There is a whole, God, there is just an industry for that, you know, for like, well, I read the book I was supposed to read because I felt so bad about the racism, and now I think you'll find I have created enough distance that I feel like I'm fine, right? Like this idea of like absolution, right? The pity motivated act absolves someone of guilt, and therefore it stops. It sort of clears the, there's a financial metaphor I'm trying to make here, right? It like, okay, now we're even. You got me to do something because I felt bad for you, but now I did it, so we're even. And I don't have to engage with you any further.
I don't have to engage with you, and I don't have to feel bad.
Yes.
I can sleep at night because I did the thing.
I did the thing. Yeah. I did the thing. Yeah. And again, on this purely practical level, like I know people who like work for certain charities or are doing certain good work where it's like, if you just gave me money because you feel bad, or if you gave me money for some other reason, I don't really care. I'm trying to run this important operation doing good work. But again, love is sustainable.
That was this woman in the game last night, right? Like, I don't give a shit if you really love me. I just need you to save my fucking town. Like,
yeah. And that, again, that emphasizes the distance between them. That creates a relationship that is transactional, right?
Yeah.
I have induced some guilt. If you wish to ameliorate your guilt, you can do something for me, and then we're square and you can leave. Yeah. As where, again, like, I think framing pity and love as these opposed things says a lot about pity, but it also says a lot about love and what love really is, which is a reciprocal relationship, and which is non-transactional fundamentally, that I do things because I love you and you do things because you love me. And therefore it's a reciprocal, we both, you know, prioritize each other's well-being, but there is no sense and there is no desire that at some point our commitments will be fulfilled and we'll be back to zero. We will have resolved the, you know, whatever we owe each other, whatever. And we're back to neutral. And like, you know, when you love someone, you look for ways to help them. And that doesn't mean you empty your cup completely and destroy yourself for the sake of them. Right. But And this is
hopefully not.
Well, I mean, this is also like the difference between acting out of love and acting out of a complete lack of love for yourself. And so you try to justify your existence. Anyway, I'm a therapist when I'm not a game designer, but I won't get into it. Just that, like, it's also like self-love, right?
Yeah.
Loving oneself means prioritizing one's well-being. It doesn't mean doing that necessarily over any other particular person or constantly giving yourself everything you want, but it does mean like, oh, but I do love myself, so I will do my best to prioritize me being okay. being well. Yeah. And yeah, in that sense, like, again, coming back to this fact that, oh, there are different kinds of love. Now I almost want to say the exact opposite, which is there are different kinds of relationships. There are romantic relationships and paternal relationships and friendships and admiration, you know, mentorships, whatever. But ultimately, like, the love, love is just love. Like, there are different relationships, but love is just what it is. And so, again, like, thinking about this 14-year-old orphan who just wanted his protection so bad, to love that person was to take care of her and look out for her and be reliable and all of these other things, right? Loving a child is different than loving an adult, is different than loving your own parent, is different than loving your romantic partner, is different than acting with love towards someone who you maybe just know for a very brief period of time. I truly believe that the way that you love a hookup and the way that you love your partner who you've been with for 50 years, those relationships are really different. But I think, like, the definition of love remains the same, like that kind of priority.
The expressions feel different.
Yeah.
But the core feels very similar.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Sanguis populi, the blood of the people, the dark protectors of the hidden city of Azeroth, deep within the illusory forest, familiar with death as they have eluded it, they are called upon for a desperate task, slaying a creature from the great beyond. Blythe.
This might not be easy, being surrounded by death. I don't understand how they can do it.
Elvira.
Someone must watch the bodies, and none do so as diligently.
Swan.
Into action so fast. I love when we get to go out.
It came from the sky. This great pale monstrosity.
You just had to sate your hunger. You couldn't have saved it for the beasts.
I prefer the gratuity.
Vampirism is not immortality. It only prolongs the inevitable. Is this the end for Sanguis Populi? Blood in the snow. A tale yet told. Halloween 2025.
Sorceress, lower the barrier for just a moment. Sanguis Populi departs.
Listen to Tale Is Yet Told wherever you get your podcasts.
So another thing I wanted to make sure we talked about was you brought this up like right away, the idea of naming the negative space in a game, like naming mechanics that don't quote unquote do anything.
Yeah.
Like, it's easy to imagine a version of this game where instead of Kagamatsu handing out a love point or a pity point, he either hands out a love point or does not. Mm-hmm. And the naming of the option to not hand out a love point as pity opens up all of the discussion we have had today, right?
Yeah.
Just by giving name to, like, an absence. Mm-hmm. And I find that really beautiful and compelling. I don't know that I have more to say about it or what to ask about it, but
totally,
I just wanted to put it out there.
That's fine, because I have an infinite well of things to say about it.
Good. Go on.
I think lots of people have said some version of this, but Graham Walmsley, in his most recent newsletter — you should subscribe to Graham's newsletter — you know, just wrote this thing called What Do Dice Do? And it's really, oh my God, did you read it? Good. Oh my gosh, so good.
So good.
Like just nice little diagrams and everything. And he talks about like, here are many of the things that dice can do and the way in which they represent a kind of fork in the road, right? In of a story. And one thing that he really emphasizes is that if the fork in the road, right, is between the thing you want to happen happens and nothing happens, like either a thing happens or it doesn't, then that's not very compelling. You want to have multiple options that are at least at the bare minimum, something happens. And ideally, those things that happen should be interesting and they should be different every time, you know, and they should fit the themes of the game and so on, right? And so that's the thing that separates this from the equally fascinating contempt tokens from the Quiet Year, where the contempt tokens are kind of spontaneous. You just put them out there when you feel the need to. And so they're like unprompted. And there's just this way of sort of making visible the contempt that is building up in the community.
Yeah.
And everyone can see them and look at them. And you have to sort of acknowledge that. As where the pity points are hidden, you don't actually ever know how many you know, pity points you have, or you never know when Kagematsu is assigning love or pity. But knowing that they are there, the concept of the pity point, the terror of the pity point, right, means that something is always happening. That, you know, again, dice are rolled and either you succeed or fail. And then also either you have acquired the love that you want or you have acquired pity. And the difference between that and you've gotten love or you didn't, right?
Yeah.
Like the game would just be so much less compelling if it was either like, well, Kagematsu looks at you and he's filled with love, or he goes, eh. Not really doing
take
it for me.
It.
Yeah, it's all right. Sorry, babe. What'd you say? I was playing Smash. Like, right? Yeah. Like that's the lack of response. It's not interesting. It's this thing that is not visible in the way that contempt is, but it is like this haunting specter. It is this quantum thing over the game. And in a way, like it informs, I think, Kagematsu's play, because you really look and you see how much pity you have for each character. And that, I think, informs how you engage with them when it's like the pity is visible in front of you. But even as an invisible thing, it is the other thing that can happen, and it makes failure more interesting. And it is it is making sure that the dice always do something, that there is no neutral response. And that, in fact, like, and that the other option is pity. Like, I think this would be, again, I think this would be a much less effective, interesting game if it was just love or nothing. I think it would be a totally different game if it was like love or anger. That's a profoundly different game. Or love or...
I wrote that down in my notes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, and the thing is, that is another thing that can happen when people get the sense that you are trying to manipulate them, right? That you are trying to get them to do something. Is they can get angry. And I think that would add a powerfully different dimension to this game.
Yes.
That, you know, someone else can explore, but I'm not interested in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would agree.
Yeah. And so it explicitly says, if you're not getting love, you're getting pity. And that changes the way that you play. It amplifies the power differential between Kagematsu and the players so much. It is not just your GM that you can kind of taunt and tease and ignore the plans of and sort of lash out as. It is someone who you never know exactly where you stand with. And so you're doing your best. But also, if you're really obviously doing your best, then he's just going to feel bad for you because you look so desperate.
Yeah.
Yeah. What an uncomfortable position to be in.
Yeah. Yeah. Must be bad.
Must be awful.
There was something that my Kagematsu yesterday said as we were debriefing about the game, was that it felt cruel to give pity. Mm-hmm. And that because pity and love are not transparent to the townswomen, that it was not clear to the townswomen that that cruelty was happening as it was happening. And that that felt powerful and also sad, I think, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to ask you, as someone who has played as Kagematsu, what the experience for you is like of handing out pity and love tokens.
It feels bad, definitely. Pity doesn't feel good. And I will say that this mechanic, again, it's very, very explicit that this is based on your personal reaction to the scene. It's almost like something you are more like acknowledging than deciding. And so it, like, because it's really based on that, it's just like, you kind of have to be honest with yourself about how you feel and what that evoked in you. And again, you have no particular incentive. You're not really against the players. You have no particular incentive to give one or the other. And so you kind of just have to, like, be honest with yourself. And I think the fact that it is hidden from the other player allows you to do that. I think it would be a totally different move to give someone pity right in front of their face.
Yeah.
And be like, you just earned yourself a pity point. Like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because again, because it's a power thing. And so I think it doesn't feel good, but also it doesn't feel bad enough that you don't do it. And I think on some level, it feels bad. And I think on some level, it also feels good. I just do think that there is a reason why humans go around arranging themselves in unbelievably complex, whatever, read Foucault, not me, right, of these bizarre power structures. And on some level, it feels good. And you have to contend with that. In the same way that I will say that being a townswoman subject to love and pity and trying to win the affections and being in this, like, impossible position also feels good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels nice to not have the responsibility of actually making very many choices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. I didn't think I was going to, like, actually quote Foucault. Okay, thankfully, it's not within my grasp, even though I'm near my bookshelf. But Foucault, in The History of Sexuality, he talks about, like, this comparison that he makes between the doctor's office or the psychoanalyst's office and the confession booth. And to a certain extent, even the, like, the confessions being extracted from people during the Inquisition, the Inquisitor and the extraction. And he talks about how, intentionally or otherwise, it does set up a situation, this perpetual obsession with confession and the confession of crimes, the confession of sins, the confession of your personal history and the things that you're neurotic about, the confession of whatever health thing is going on with you. He really says it sets up this feeling of this dynamic of that is to some degree motivated by the pleasure of seeking and of finding out and of demanding and of forcing the other person to tell the truth and of exerting that kind of power, and the pleasure of evading and the pleasure of confessing and making oneself vulnerable, the pleasure of dodging or giving into or whatever that demand. And, you know, in various ways, he argues that that is part of what sustains those dynamics, which is a separate argument, but that does exist. And that is why, you know, I really started this conversation talking about power, because that is the interesting thing that Kagematsu does, is instead of just saying, well, let's take the existing power dynamic that we're all familiar with and try to neutralize it, or let's take that and crank it up to 1,000, right? Let's just play around. Let's see what we got. Let's do something. Let's switch this, move that around. Okay, how's this power dynamic?
Yeah.
How's that working for you? And yeah, the answer is it's quite interesting. And we should, I kind of wish we'd talk more about the fact that, like, I've been Kagematsu many times, although not in a long time, I will say. But I've never been a townswoman, and you've never been a Kagematsu.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had assumed that you would have been a townswoman at some point. No. That's interesting.
I think I have the excuse that no one else has ever wanted to GM it, but I might just not be versed in that sense. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Mm. Cool. Do you have any questions you'd be curious to hear me answer about what it's like to play a townswoman?
How does it feel to see your pity score at the end of the game?
Huh. So for me, I had 5 love and 0 pity.
Right.
And that felt really good.
Mm-hmm.
I know the person who had 0 love and 5 pity also felt really good about that, because that's what he had been angling for.
Right.
But for me, I want the pat on the head.
Yeah.
And it was good to receive the pat on the head.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked about how this game brings up people's ideas about what is being flirty or what is being adorable or what is being, yeah, right, all these other things, lovable, right? And, you know, I made a two-player game about love, and it is very strict about what players do because it's about flirting, and I teach you how to flirt. I don't just say flirt. Yeah. I'm like, increase intimacy between the two of you by doing these specific things.
I have learned how to flirt from that game to some extent.
Thank you. That makes me really happy. But this game is just like, okay, go for it. Do it. Do whatever you think, you know, would acquire this affection. And so that, I think, makes it more intense, and that gives it that kind of squirmy, okay, I want this to work feeling that is, you know, beautiful and very much intended. But also... But also, that makes me wonder about what is it really like to look at the Kagematsu player scratching their little point on their paper and wondering whether or not it's pity, right? And and I wonder about what it's like to see your pity score at the end. I really don't know.
You know, the moment of watching Kagematsu make that mark is, for me, it was like, I know I did the right thing in this scene. I know I acted the way I wanted to. Mm-hmm. I know I wouldn't change anything, right? Mm. And I know what I expect. Like, I felt something in this scene, and I'm pretty confident that that's love.
Yeah.
But what if it's not? What if I was wrong?
Yeah.
What if I felt a connection and they did not? Mm-hmm. And... the fear of that, even with all the confidence that I had after every scene, the fear of, but what if it was just me feeling that, was what came out in that moment.
Yeah, which is a powerful thing and a resonant thing, I think, with people's very real lives. And and I really think about the reverse as well, of when you think, well, you know, someone's doing this or saying this because they feel bad for me. And if you find out that, no, I'm doing it or I'm saying it because I love you, like, that's equally strong, right, in the other direction. Yeah. And so I wonder if people have had that experience. Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of validation, I think, in confirming that you were seen the way you wanted to be seen.
Oh, so true. And this is why your friend, with all the pity points, either decided early on or... I would suspect decided at some point when they realized that this was kind of how it was going to go. Oh, you know what? I want to be pitied. Because as soon as you decide that, you're like, great, no problem. I'm in.
Yeah,
I can achieve that.
Exactly.
But being seen the way you want to be seen, I think is a good way of putting it.
So you want to make a robots game of this?
Thank you for that smooth segue. I do. So here's the thing is that for every reason that we've been talking about, this game is very compelling. It's really interesting and it produces a pretty unique experience. But I've run it a million times, but I don't know if I'll ever run it again. It's not something I would offer at a game convention. Hmm. It's a game that has a lot of flaws and, you know, a lot of it is just that it is kind of finicky and is written, again, in a 2009 way, right? It can be a little bit hard to use as a text sometimes. But there's also, I think a lot about the setting actually limits the story in many ways. And there's, I think it is difficult to do a good job of being a bunch of people at a table playing mostly women in Sengoku era Japan. And in my experience of playing this with, again, mostly white people, not exclusively, but mostly, is that best case scenario, it sounds more like a Kurosawa movie than like real life. And worst case scenario, it sounds like a bad anime. And neither of those are real things that people have experienced. And I won't get too much into this, partially because I was on the One Shot podcast a couple of years ago now, and I played this game. We had a wonderful game of it. And then I was still doing my podcast Backstory at the time, and I had James Mendez Hodes on, who is a brilliant designer, brilliant writer, lovely guy, and also a cultural consultant. And so I had him on mostly to talk about his work, which is quite interesting, but I also was like, so you heard that game, what did you think? And we have a more fulsome discussion than you and I can have here about like, what it means for people who are not Asian to have written this Asian setting, and
yeah,
and how that fits into the broader history of like role-playing games, which are often set in space and in fantasy worlds, to then for some reason also be set in like Japan and China a lot, and like exotification, and to what extent can you work against that? To what extent does this game, which does contain a bunch of information about life in Sengoku or Japan, which is quite interesting, and like, anyway, there's a bunch of limitations. And also, again, today I don't think you'd publish a game where it's like, well, this role has to be played by a woman, and kind of with the assumption that everyone else at the table is a man. In fact, I can't remember now the last time I've played with that kind of setup, which was at the time so common. So I think for various reasons, it's not as well suited to the current gaming milieu as it was then. But lots of people have played with this formula in one way or another. The game is out of print. The game was published by Danielle Lewon and based on a design by Renee Knipp. And for various reasons, they have kept it out of print. And I don't know exactly why, but I mean, literally, like, this game that I, like, this copy contains, as far as I can tell, multiple people's dead names. Like, it's old and it would need some work. So they have just left it
out. I saw at least one dead name in the credits.
Yeah, exactly. So that, I think, is indicative of, like, you know, you wouldn't just make another printing or just put the PDFs up somewhere. It needs a bit of care. And whether they've opted not to do that or have been like, it's whatever. I have deleted much of my own work. And I think every artist reserves the right to do so. Yes. But for that and so many reasons, right, that it is this thing that is incredibly compelling and also very flawed. That's catnip to people who want to make things, right? Like, you don't write fan fiction about the perfect thing. You write fan fiction about the thing that needs a little needs a little adjustment. So there was, let me think, Kagematsu, which is basically kind of, instead of townswomen, you have these other men. I don't know a ton about it. As far as I can tell, it's kind of like a reverse Seven Samurai, where instead of one guy trying to recruit seven samurais, it's like a bunch of samurais being like, yo, come on in, which is amazing. I think somewhere out there, there's like a Regency era hack of it, right?
Oh, yeah.
A gentleman in possession of a good fortune must be pursued by multiple women, which is obviously like a perfect spot for it. And there's probably more that I don't know of. But something that I have not been able to get out of my head for years and years and years, the time will come, is to kind of take the basis of this game and change a lot of it. And to set it in space with robots. This is my dream.
Makes everything better. Why would it not work here too?
Yeah, first of all, that's always my question. Why isn't this in space? Okay, so picture this. There's a space station that was like basically a fancy resort. And things have changed in the quadrant. It's not really a popular spot anymore. And in fact, it's become totally abandoned. The people who ran it have long since left. And they kind of just left it and had to go somewhere else. And so it's just this lovely, beautiful, but kind of crumbling space, like an abandoned mall, maybe. But it's still full of all of the androids that were created to work in it. And they are like, A, just kind of programmed to help people have a nice time. And B, I think they can't hurt people. It is against their programming. It is impossible for them to hurt people. And so instead of townswomen, you have those. And there is some kind of recurring threat. There is a person or maybe people who are coming periodically or are about to come who wreck shop, right? Who are like, oh, these are just robots. Mm. We can do whatever we want. And they're just kind of like looting the place, or they're kicking robots around or whatever, right? That's kind of up to the players to figure out what is the extent of what these robots need protection from. But yeah, then someone comes along, a human, and the robots all kind of realize, oh, this is like a nice human. This is a good human. And maybe they're like a big sort of tough bounty hunter or something, some other spacey thing, right? Or a Federation officer or something.
At least all the robots think they are.
Yeah, exactly. That the robots are like, maybe this human could protect us from these others. So again, the structure is kind of the same. The affections might be a bit different, and the, you know, lots of things would be different. But that structure of these individual scenes in which the robot tries to convince the person who has the power to do what they need to do, to do it, and somehow to do that in a way that gives them the genuine, real, enduring motivation of love, and not the empty, guilt-ridden, you know, doing the least I possibly can motivation of pity. That's my plan. I've announced it. Now I have to do it.
Yeah, you have to. That's the gamer law. All right, Alex, is there anything else you want to say about Kagamatsu or pity points?
I don't think so. I guess maybe I want everyone to think more about intangible mechanics and what they can and can't do and play with them. And also I want to beat the drum of playtesting. That you can figure out what math does by doing math, but you can only figure out what an intangible, how something is intangibly represented when you actually get it to the table, right? And play it with people. So I just want to encourage all the designers to like play around with this and really play around with it and see what happens when you make intangible things visible or explicit in some way.
Yeah. I would add to that, it was so refreshing to play a game from before the time when all games were hacks of other games. Not that, like, I love hacks of other games, you know? Like, I love the fact that Powered by the Apocalypse, like, exists.
Oh my gosh,
there.
Yeah.
Like,
what a
all
blessing.
Of the stuff like that. What a gift. And also, this was just weird and different, you know? It just felt unique. Mm-hmm. And I would love to see more games coming from the depths of your heart without the wonderful assistance of an existing framework.
Yes. And I mean, then again, one of the things that makes this game different, because, you know, it is from 2009, is just the fact that indie gaming truly was like a scene and was not yet an industry. And it is an industry now. Yeah. And that means you have a lot of incentive to give people something that is at least building upon something that they already know how to do.
Yeah.
Really, really like hyper incentivized, right? To give people something that is a twist on something that they already recognize and can be comfortable with. Boy, back in those days, I mean, you were like, I don't think anyone is going to want to play this anyway. So I guess I'll just make it whatever I feel like and see what happens.
And it is, of course, easier to make a twist on something. And great designer training wheels. Like, I don't want to, like, knock that kind of design and get. Love games.
I literally just said, I want to hack this game. Like, I'm pro.
Exactly,
I'm in favor.
Like, we're all, StarCross is a hack of dread, right? Yeah. Like, I'm making For the Queen hacks out here all the time. Like, we get it. Yeah. But, Alex, thank you so much for being here on Dice Explorers.
Oh my gosh.
Really, just a joy to have you.
Thank you for talking to me. This was really, really fun.
Holy shit. Thanks again to Alex for being here. You can find links to For the Queen, StarCrossed, Backstory, and her newsletter in the show notes. As always, you can find me on socials at S. Dunnewald or on the Dice Exploder Discord. Our logo was designed by Sporgery. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And our ad music is Lily Pads by my boy, Travis Tesmer. And thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.